You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
This is the Book Riot Podcast. It's a weekly news and talk show about what's new, cool, and worth talking about in the world of books and reading. And this is, in a lot of places, it's their big show of the year. We don't really think of it this way. Weirdly, Rebecca, it's our favorite books of 2022. Mm-hmm. I don't know what our big show of the year is, but because we're just two people, it's not like the New York Times or something like that, where we have a copious staff and a highly produced interactive widget or anything. It's just our favorite books of the year for 2022. I guess we haven't talked about organization, how many we're picking. I'm going to use my heuristic where I get to pick one out of every 10 books I've read. So okay. I've got 14 at this point. I don't know how many you have. Before we get started, we'll do a sponsor break. Good year in reading. The New York Times book 10 best books of the list came out, and you were very charitable to text me and make me feel better about my existential crisis, because I have read four of those 10. And I guess my question to you is, now as Project Front List winds down, is 4 out of 10 a good showing for me in this project or not? You seem to want to like attaboy me, and I don't know if that was just to make me feel better or if that was genuine, a little bit of both. Look, I'll take the attaboy. Don't get me wrong, but like, I don't know. I'm trying to figure out if I should have thought of an over-under at the beginning.
That's interesting.
I don't know. I guess I feel two kinds of way. But what do you think as a neutral party?
You know, I think 4 out of 10 is pretty good. And I will admit that's coming from my own reading perspective of like most years I read a lot of front list. So it kind of felt like you were coming into my clubhouse and we got to hang out in that space together this year. And most years, if I hit somewhere between 3 and 6 of the 10 on the New York Times top 10, I feel pretty good about it. Like there are thousands of new books every year and hundreds probably that I would have enjoyed and found worthy of being on my top list if I had read them, that it's nice to like be reminded of that. I'm never going to hit all 10 probably. It would just be a weird, that's just such a weird coincidence. It would be unlikely to happen. But yeah, I think 4 is pretty good. Like a good, I think you took a really good sampling of the new books that were out this year. The New York Times employs many more people than the two of us to read and review books. Yeah. So they can take a much broader survey of what's out there than we can. And yeah, I feel pretty good about that. It was a genuine attaboy of a like, look, you didn't miss the mark just because the National Book Award had a weird shortlist.
You're weird. I'm not weird. You're weird.
Yeah. And I always like this show. I agree that this is not our like big show of the year. But I like that it's faves instead of best. Like we're not trying to confer some big award upon these. And some of these I do think are among the best books of the year, but coming to it from favorites and that, you know, favorite reading experience is a nice framework for me. I had 14 on my long list. I'm going to hit about 75 or 80 books this year. So if I do 14, it'll be, you know, 20% of my list. I've had a really strong hit rate this year. So I feel really good about that. I don't know that I need to name all 14 of them. Some of them I'm sure we're going to have overlap on. So I might just, you know, piggyback when you hit those, but there's definitely 8 that I would be like, yes, this is a reading experience I'm still thinking about. It was definitely a favorite, and 14 that were strong enough that I would want to recommend them, I guess is where I'm going to leave it.
We'll get to a sponsor here in a minute and we'll get into some more of our framing devices for our list. One other follow-up thing. I don't want to let it go till we do our next news show, which will be sometime in March of 2023, according to our No, it's going to be a little while. A lot of feedback about the Mystery 2.5 million print run book. Mm-hmm. I think a couple of readers who did a little more metadata searching than I did, I think they've got it right, which is this is going to be a Colleen Hoover title.
Yes.
And the thing that threw me off, frankly, was the hardback. And she doesn't release in hardback initially. That's the rise of the trade paperback in middle grade all the way up through adult, I think largely led by the TikTok backlist phenomenon. Mm-hmm. had me a little confused, and I'm not even sure that it will be hardback, frankly. I wonder if that's another thing they're saying hardback because they can use it to do dissembling about what the title actually is. But I think this... we're not taking any more bets on this. I'm pretty sure it's going to be Colleen Hoover. Some people are like, yeah. Donna Tartt. And the Gold Flame sold pretty well. Some people are like, it sold 3.2. I was like, it may have done that. A, it's a different world. B, that's not in the initial print run. They didn't print 3 million. That book sold in hardcover for, what, 2.5 years, Rebecca? Like, that was a genuine phenomenon.
It was, yeah. I think the thing that I said to folks on Patreon who were theorizing that it was going to be Donna Tartt is like, I want to live in the world where Donna Tartt is a big enough deal to have a 2.5 million first print run. And I think I agree that we got tripped up on the hardback because that night that we were texting, trying to figure out like, what is going on? What is this mystery book? I tossed out, it could be Colleen Hoover. Right. And then we talked ourselves out of it with like, well, it doesn't fit the profile. It's a hardback. Like she's not going to sell that many. And It Ends With Us this year. But this is the follow on. The theory is this is like the follow on to Verity. And Verity was a huge, huge deal. I think bigger than we can grasp. And that email from the listener, I do suspect is right. So the most obvious answer turns out to have probably been the answer, I guess.
And the one theoretical one, like what if it were imprint agnostic and you were just trying to like, who's got their hat in the rings that could do a print run like this? Someone brought up, or maybe I brought it. It was brought up after our initial wave. And I think after we recorded, George R. R. Martin.
Yeah.
Now again, tough look for George that we didn't even think of him, but frankly, he hasn't released a book in 12 years, so it's not top of mind right now.
Yeah, and but, also they're not like, oh, sorry, they're not like sliding in a George R. R. Martin book for 4 months from now with a cover to be revealed thing. Like the release date for that thing is going to be announced bajillions of years in advance with much fanfare and many pre-orders.
Right. Well, but I guess my thinking was, would it get a 2.5 million print run? And I think it probably would. I don't know what our appetite for this. Like we've said before, we're in the weirdest spot ever for an IP situation with George. And the distaste, it seems like most fans had for the end of the TV show, I think have only certain to heighten the interest in the books. Like, what was George going to zag from the zig, even though apparently he was or was not involved in this? It's all very unclear. What's that fan base is doing? I don't know. We don't have a while the show was live really example of what that appetite is going to be. I could certainly believe it's going to sell 2.5 million copies in hardback. But again, I think it's a Penguin. Maybe I can't remember which one of the fantasy titles, one of the fantasy imprints. Maybe it's just doubled. It doesn't matter. But that's the only other one we could think of that maybe would be in the ballpark. But right now, our Bayesian prior is if there's a huge book coming out with a huge print run, it's a Colleen Hoover title. And that's the world we're going to be living in until proven otherwise. So let's do a sponsor, and then we'll get into their favorite books of the year.
Today's episode is brought to you by Revel Fiction and Double Take, the first book in a breathtaking new series from Lynette Eason. Detective James Cross has been honorably discharged from the Army Criminal Investigation Division due to wounds sustained. Meanwhile, physician assistant Lainey Jackson is going through some things. She's 18 months out from an attempted murder perpetrated by her ex, which ended when she managed to grab the weapon and shoot him. When he appears to have survived and is back to finish the job he started, Lainey insists it's not possible. But someone is trying to kill her, and she does keep seeing his face. So, Lainey and James must work together to find out who exactly is after her and why he wants her dead, and failure is not an option. Pick up Double Take by Lynette Eason for tight and fast-paced writing. U.S. Today bestselling author Lynette Eason will leave you breathless with this new book. It's the first in a brand new series. Thanks again to Revel Fiction and Double Take, the first book in a breathtaking new series from Lynette Eason, for sponsoring this episode.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
favorite, best, I don't know how to do this. I'm trying to scratch multiple itches with my list. I realize if slight different, I know it's going to shock you, that slightly different word choice would have slightly different lists. One list that occurred to me that would be fun to do at some point and maybe in a future year or some other iteration, like the books that made me happiest while reading them is not this list, weirdly, because I am messed up and not a well person, I guess, to some degree. But these are the way I'm thinking about these are my favorite books of the year, sort of. But they're the books I'm most glad to have experienced, I think, is that's the one that's easiest for me to understand. Because then you can account for the Schindler's List problem. And you know what I'm talking about here, right?
Yes.
Which is Schindler's is a great movie, tough hang. And that doesn't mean it's your favorite. Is it your favorite? Is it the best? Or how glad are you to have had the Schindler's List experience? I think that completely reframes the question and feels a little bit like a lawyer's trick to get out of some difficult decisions. But I will take getting off on a technicality at this point.
I support that technicality. That's pretty close to the way that I think about what my favorites are in any given year. Like, what were the most maybe valuable or important reading experiences? Mm-hmm. The stuff, the books that I'm taking something with me into, you know, the rest of my life, because I've had great fun reading experiences, stuff I was really happy to be reading at the time, but then you close the book and never think about it again.
Yeah.
And that's its own, I think, important kind of reading experience. Right. That's like really what I'm trying to do on vacation or on a plane. you know, those are meaningful in their own right, but most of those kinds of book experiences are not the things that are going to, for me, show up on an end of the year list where I'm recapping, like, what was a meaningful experience similar to you? What am I really glad that I spent time with this year?
Yeah. All right. Well, let's just trade back and forth. And if one of us has a shared title, we can spend a moment on it. Mine aren't any order. Are yours?
I
need to sleep at some point. I can't worry about this much. would you like to begin?
Yeah, I thought maybe we could just take a couple shared faves off the board to start, the stuff we've talked about a lot over the course of the year. And that's my trio of The 90s by Klosterman, How to Be Perfect by Michael Schur, and Heartbreak by Florence Williams.
I have all three of those on my list. Interestingly, four of my 14 I had read by like February 8th. Mm-hmm. And because those came hot out of the gate. Heartbreak was a February release. I think 90s was a January release.
And it was early in the year, yeah.
Yeah. I had all four of those. And for me, did you do any of those on audio?
How to Be Perfect, because you had gotten it, you got to it a little bit before I did. Yeah. And I think I had started the digital galley, and you were like, dude, the ebook or the audiobook, get on that. And
I think all three of them would make my list of my five favorite audiobooks of the year.
And Heartbreak, yes, on audio.
Heartbreak,
for sure.
I mean, it's absolute the right. That's
It was amazing.
It's amazing on audio. I'm not sure what else to say about these. I think these are, I'm not sure what to say about these, and here's a bunch of stuff to say. That's the Jeff O'Neill way. They are the kind of mix we like of personal, intellectual, emotional, and casual, informally serious kind of books at the same time. Heartbreak probably has the most serious subject matter in it, but dealt with a real human, if not self-deprecating, at least self-aware approach. And I think that's something all three of these books are. They're taking on heady material, and it could be patronizing, condescending, or otherwise off-putting to deal with an entire decade, or, you know, one of the parts of the human condition, or just, you know, how to be the perfect person. You need a little, if not a wink, a little shrug and a maybe and a check this out and I'm trying to figure this out. And I'm not sure that's something 10 years ago you had a lot of when dealing with these topics.
I agree. I think they feel really inviting. Mm-hmm. Like inviting, all three authors are like, hey, come on in and let's do this together. And that approach of, I guess, to borrow language from some of the other communities that I see, that approach of like co-creating with the reader what's going on, I find to be just really fun. It's a great, like, fun in a meaningful way of let's learn some stuff. Let's like get in there, and we could use the Brene Brown, like, let's rumble through some of the stuff about being human. I do not love that verb, but I think it kind of works here. Florence Williams inviting us into her moment of heartbreak and saying, I know you felt something like this in your life too, or that you're going to, and so let's talk about it. And Michael Schur being like, everybody goes through weird dilemmas about what's the right thing to do here, and he shares his own, you know, foibles and mistakes and the stuff that prompted him to be interested in moral philosophy in the first place. And then Klosterman being like, a bunch of us lived through the 90s and here's how we understood it at the time, but here's what it looks like with some perspective. I really wish I had listened to the 90s on audio, and then I kind of double wish that the folks at Pushkin had gotten a hold of it so that it could have been an audio experience with, like, you know, excerpts of, like, Ross Perot giving his lectures on late night TV and, you know, examples from his graphs, and then some audio of, like, 90s boy bands and the other sorts of stuff that Klosterman talks about, and movie clips. Like, it feels like it could have really yes. been a sort of multi-dimensional audio experience, and maybe I doubt it'll happen, but, like,
it's a writer's nightmare, apparently. I mean, even it just is, just to get 90 seconds of, yeah, you know, Smells Like Teen Spirit, it's really hard to do without paying $1 jillion.
Right. I wonder about, like, if it had been a year-long podcast about the history of the 90s, that where Spotify could have just, you know, given them the music at least.
That's right. That would be an interesting way to do it.
It would have been super interesting, but I really was glad for all three of those reading experiences for that. I like your language there, kind of casually informative. Mm-hmm. And Klosterman and Schur, I think those topics especially could have trended way too academic. There's a way of doing cultural history that's pretty dry. Yeah. There's definitely a way of doing moral philosophy that's really dry. And the thing that made How to Be Perfect so good was that it was just so far from dry. It wasn't somebody coming down from an ivory tower. It was somebody who's, like, in the mix with normal people every day.
And I think in this moment too, there's, and I think both Schur and Klosterman are aware of it, there's a white guy telling you how things are possibility that you need to figure out your way around if you want to mm-hmm. write about these topics, which I think they both did pretty well. And Klosterman, the way Klosterman did is, like, he's trying to capture in a way his own experience, trying to remember what it was like at the same time we're writing about it. I'm not sure there's a greater expert on 90s pop culture than Chuck Klosterman, honestly. And he still came with it with a very, I think, trends more sort of personally cerebral than the others. But he's like, mm-hmm. I'm trying to figure this out. And, like, that I'm trying to figure this out vibe, I think, is essential in these kinds of pop mainstream titles. It's not, you know, there are real experts and they should tell us how to do things and how things are. But in these particular cases, the I'm trying to figure this out, come along with me, is the best way to get us onto your roller coaster.
So approachable.
I guess I will maybe try to RSTLNE some of our shared favorites. Speaking of people who know things and just tell them how they are, I assume Song of the Cell
of
made
course.
It onto your list. Mukherjee doesn't need to perform for me the I'm just trying to figure this
no.
out.
No. No, he knows things and he's here to tell us.
We've talked about this recently at length. I'm not sure what else there is to say about it. I guess the only thing I would say in a meta point of view, I'm not seeing it as on as many lists as I was expecting for best books, best nonfiction. I don't know why that is. Maybe it's a little too it gets pretty sciencey, I guess, as Mukherjee does. But I think he does a good job of holding your hand all the way to the down to the petri dish. But maybe it's not the same as some of the political or cultural stuff that tends to meet, or I don't know, softer sciencey kinds of things that tend to make the list. I mean, just look at the New York Times best books of the year. Like, the nonfiction is. Ed Yong made that list. It's not quite as sciencey as Song of the Cell. No shouts to Ed, but Song of the Cell is a little more in the lab, and I like that. But I don't know why. It's clearly, to me, my favorite science book of the year, and I've read a few. I've not read the whole corpus, but Song of the Cell, Rebecca. Anything else to say there?
Yeah, I have Song of the Cell on my list. I didn't have Immense World on my faves of the year, which just, I guess, differences of opinion there between us and the New York Times. I do think Song of the Cell was wonkier than Emperor of All Maladies and The Gene. the genes, I thought, felt skewed a little more sciencey than Emperor of All Maladies. But like, there's such a big narrative to Emperor of All Maladies, and everyone can relate to the story of cancer in some way. It's more work to read about, you know, genetics or to read about cellular biology, and the details are, I think, more challenging. I definitely felt like I was working more for Song of the Cell, yeah. And I both wanted the experience to last a while, so I was reading like a chapter a day or like 20 pages a day for a while, but also I needed that time to really digest the information. I feel like Mukherjee is a masterful teacher, yeah. And I love to be in his classroom. I'm there for whatever he wants to write about. Song of the Cell, I think, is all of his books, but this one is a really just masterful approach to science and the story around science, both what we know and how we came to know it. And I think he really grasps in a way that a lot of science writers don't, that the how we came to know it is the really interesting human part of the story. That's the story. Who were these people? What were they doing? How did they get these ideas? How did they make these discoveries? What mistakes did they make along the way? Once they figured the thing out, how did it land? Like, if you put the three books together, there are just dozens of stories in them about people who figured out something major and it either didn't land or it caused like a huge ruckus in the scientific community, or they have like ongoing feuds with other scientists and somebody gets vindicated 25 years later when someone else confirms that that was the thing all along when everyone had been doubting the first guy who figured it out. And that human stuff of how science gets made, I just find to be so compelling. And I feel like Mukherjee has latched onto a really unique way of getting into to this difficult subject matter by telling the human stories around it that I would love for more science writers to do.
If there's one thing Mukherjee likes better than the beauty of nature, it's the beauty of someone taking a microscope and putting it somewhere someone hadn't put it before and being like, whoa, there's a whole world in ocean water. Look at all this junk floating around in here. And he builds his own microscope after he's taught and he's written his 3,000 words. Then he builds his own microscope because apparently he's Robert Downey Jr. crossed with Mary Curie, and that's cool, and then not at all threatening, and everything's fine.
He might be the most interesting man in the world.
Yeah. The only slag I have on Mukherjee, and it's a very, very slight one, and this would really be like to Voltron into the perfect writer, if he was like 9% funnier, that would be the only thing I would take, because some of it's kind of silly. Not silly, but like it's weird and abstract, and that's not his vibe. And if I have to trade that for him being like, I'm also going to talk about Ishiguro in this chapter, I wouldn't trade that. But if he could do also a little bit of a little more humor for it, then it would be kind of the ultimate pop science nonfiction title.
Yes.
That was the only piece, I think, that's not in the full orchestra right now. But you could leave the timpani out. It's okay.
Yeah, we're still going to enjoy the sonata. He gets some good wordplay in Song of the Cell, and it's been too long since The Gene and Emperor of All Maladies. I don't remember if he does that in those, but there are some good moments where you can tell like he's proud of himself for this little clever turn.
It's called Song of the Cell, for God's sakes.
Right. And some of them are really pretty funny, but I also would have taken like a little more humor, or like I think there's spaces to like have issued a little funny commentary about like really how ridiculous some of these feuds between these scientists are, especially like in the 1700s where the feud happens in letters that take 4 weeks to get to each other. Like the footnotes are ripe with places that he could have gone with that. I think that transitions me to another, I know, shared love, definitely a shared favorite of mine this year. I think Ross Gay does the self-aware, really thoughtful, inviting contemplation, funny thing super well. And I think a lot of my favorites were clustered at the beginning and the end of the year. Yep. And the day that Song of the Cell and Inciting Joy came out was like the day of my year. but Inciting Joy, probably in my top three for the year, if I really had to, like, if you really, really pushed me, I just like thinking with Ross Gay. And I like the way that he sort of pushes ideas into what Steven Johnson would call the adjacent possible, where like I might not have found that next space to walk into from the room he's in with whatever it is he's thinking about. And that pulling in of all kinds of ideas, like he's talking about community, he's talking about art, then he's talking about pickup basketball, and then he's talking about building a garden, and that they're all happening in one essay. That sort of like that fullness of a really broad and deep interest in the world, and that he lets all those elements come into play. I think Ross Gay has this really beautiful way of like taking all of the things that he thinks about and all the things he's interested in, even the fun, silly ones, seriously. Mm-hmm. And there's something really compelling to me about that.
Yeah, it's on my list for sure. I'm not sure it raised quite to those heights. And some of this is just idiosyncratic bias against collections. Like, to reach the peak for me, I want the whole work to be about one thing, to be an integrated whole. And this is sort of, I mean, it is and it isn't. Like, I'm not sure how well the inciting joy heuristic works to describe all the essays there. It also doesn't matter. But when I'm comparing it to something like Song of the Cell, right, like there's a little more ambition in something like this, but it absolutely makes my top 14. Yeah, mine was bookended. My year was very much bookended. I don't know why that would be, but none of my picks come from May, June, or July, which is weird because you would think, now, a lot of wonderful books I read, and maybe we'll do some also-rans and honorable mentions. I had a real hard time with my like 14, 15, 16, but Inciting Joy was not one of the hard decisions to make. I would read a Ross Gay book every year, and I would read a Siddhartha Mukherjee book every year.
Very happily.
Yeah. I think maybe next I will go with a trio of books that I'm going to kind of group together because I've talked about them before, but I think also you will not have any three of them, though maybe we will. I talked about them before, but my commercial lit fic troika, my three-headed hydra of To Paradise, Candy House, and Sea of Tranquility all made my top 14. And looking at this, the only one that was maybe I was wobbly on a little bit in the last month or so was Sea of Tranquility. Though I looked at it again and I picked it up and kind of just spent a few minutes. That book is damn good. I mean, it is a really good polished book. And I was almost, I think I was too hard on it. Or again, it's in my top 14, so I'm not being that hard. But in looking at and cross-comparing and what I've said about it and what I've thought about it, I think I'm dinging it for perfection, which sounds dumb. Oh, that's not what I really mean. But like, it is so well executed. It almost feels, I think, here's what it is. Emily St. John Menzel is making it feeling too, it felt too easy. And then looking at it again, it's like, that's not easy. That's the hardest thing in the world to do, to make something that complicated look easy. So that made it up there. To Paradise did not look easy, and it's hard, and I'm not sure in the end it holds together, but as I've told you and I've said on the show before, that one has stuck with me. And then Candy House, I said this when we recorded our episode about it, I think it would grow, and it certainly has. I think it's held up extremely well, and when I put it in head-to-head with other lit fic that I've read this year, Candy House will just keep knocking them out. And so those are the three. My three, you know, at the beginning of the year, I could have told you these are three that will probably make my list. And it turns out good people are good at writing.
Yeah.
And they did it. They did it. Congratulations to all three of them.
Yeah. I don't have To Paradise. Right after this, we're recording for Patreon the books we missed this year. And that's at the top of my list of the books I missed this year. But I did have Candy House in my top eight, if I had to just do the top
eight. Really? Well, that's a real turnaround for you.
It is. It did what you said it would do. It has grown. I think it was complicated and interesting, and the experience of reading it itself left me in that kind of like, it was warmer than lukewarm, but I wasn't, when we talked about it, I wasn't in the space of like, this is a great book. I'm super glad to have read. I was glad to have read it, but I didn't walk away like, this is going to be one of my favorites of the year. But I continue to think about it. I continue to like recommend it to people when ideas that are related to it come up. She did something really difficult and ambitious in that book, and she plays with form in a way that I find to be really interesting. I think she's just a really brave writer.
Yes.
And is willing to try stuff that is weird and that isn't going to land with people. Like, you're coming off of, it's been 10 years, but she's coming off of Goon Squad, which was huge and is going to have an adaptation.
Beach was in between. She had one in between.
Oh, that's right.
Pretty well, but anyway.
And she could have, you can go all kinds of directions there. And I think often writers who have that kind of success either are just interested in going somewhere that's more commercial and broadly appealing, or they are kind of guided into something that's more commercial and broadly appealing because you can make yourself more money that way. You can make your agent or your publisher more money that way. And I really admire Jennifer Egan's commitment to just keeping it weird. Like, I'm going to stay here in my weird zone where chapters do all kinds of things that, and you don't know what's happening. She really, really trusts readers to figure out the weird stuff. And I value that so much as a reader when an author is like, here's a weird thing. Here's a chapter in a format you've never seen before. Is this person a cyborg or on some kind of like spy mission? I don't know. Will you know at the end?
It doesn't matter.
Right. Yeah. You might not even know at the end. Uh-huh. And that's going to end up being fine. That she just is willing to go there in a way that is, I just think, admirable and cool. And I would like more writers to be emboldened to do that. And I think she did it really successfully. So it has, yeah, it has grown in my estimation. I kept my hardcover copy, and I think I'm going to look back on that as something that I have really valued as a reading experience.
And it's interesting you mentioned recommending it, because it's so on its own that it's kind of an interesting recommendation for people, because they might be looking for something strange. And since it is essentially short stories, you can hear in my voice that doesn't quite capture, but it basically is that there's something there for everybody. And if there's one you don't particularly like, it'll be over soon. And there'll be another one that you like coming pretty quick. And I think one of the reasons I read Sea of Tranquility and Kindy House almost back to back. I was listening to something else on audio in between. And I think Sea of Tranquility, my estimation of it was impoverished by my admiration and the dopamine firing from trying to make sense of Candy House. Whereas Sea of Tranquility, you don't really have to make sense of it in the end. Like, she's going to pull you along, and it's going to be wrapped up pretty nicely by the end of Sea of Tranquility, no spoilers. Whereas Candy House is not that way. Mm-hmm. If anything, your brain is an exposed nervous system that has to deal with, you know, ambiguity and ambiguity, and also a kind of like open-endedness,
yes,
that is not as satisfying, conventionally satisfying, as something like Seeing Tranquility. Mm-hmm. And you, Rebecca, you and I are both like this, and I think our listeners know, given the choice between an interesting mess and a beautiful polished stone, we generally will be attracted to the interesting mess, but that doesn't mean we also don't like, you know, a pearl. And I think Seeing Tranquility is more of a pearl.
Yeah, Sea of Tranquility, I went like back and forth. And so I think it's 14 on my top 14. and probably for the same reasons, or many of the same reasons that you just cited. And I don't know, for me, maybe too, it suffered from proximity to station, to coming off the Station 11 adaptation.
Yeah, I didn't thought about that. Yeah.
That was like such a big, soaring and expansive emotional experience watching that show. And I've been toying with going back and watching it again over the holidays this year, just to see, because there was something about like the time of life that we were in when Station 11 was airing, and the sort of starting to come out of COVID and starting to come back to life and really living in that survival is not sufficient space, but wanting more connection and beauty and art and all of those things, that I wonder what it would be like to revisit that material now. Sea of Tranquility is, it's so polished and well done, and you get the answers kind of at the end. It's so much quieter.
Yeah.
And I think the combined dopamine hit of Candy House, and there's just the big feelings of Station 11,
right,
that Sea of Tranquility was just so quiet. I really enjoyed the reading experience.
Me too.
I haven't found myself thinking a lot about Sea of Tranquility since then, which I think is why it's at the bottom of my top 14. But I don't know. Ask me in 5 years. Mm-hmm. It might be higher.
Well, you know, there's another way of looking at these too, especially writers that have several books or have a profile of some kind. Does their most latest book burnish or detract from their corpus?
Mm.
And it certainly burnishes. Like,
yes,
Sea of Tranquility is top three Mandel, I think, at this point.
I agree.
So I'm not sure. I went and then you followed up. So why don't you take me someplace else you haven't gone?
Sure. This one I don't think is going to be on your list.
Right.
Probably my favorite memoir. Well, one of my two favorite memoirs of the year, but In the Shadow of the Mountain by Sylvia Vasquez Lovato.
This is on my, I didn't get to.
Yeah, list. Which I read pretty early in the year. It's her memoir of being one of the first women to summit all of the Seven Sisters. I know last week, maybe on one of the recommendations shows, you were talking about Nimsdai Purja and his book and documentary about climbing some of those same peaks. This is kind of sneakily not just an adventure memoir, but a recovery story. She was the victim of sexual assault as a child and as a young woman, and then became a drug and alcohol alcohol addict, sort of in an attempt to cope with those things, and also has a really successful career while she's battling addiction, but hits that breaking point and discovers for herself that really physically challenging experiences dial her into her life in a way that nothing else has. And those become the way that she copes with, you know, getting sober and staying sober and also processing the trauma of her early life. And it's thoughtful, it's funny. She's just really just so honest about her experience. And I thought it was structured really well, that the chapters moved back and forth between her present day, the present day of the story, which is trying to summit Everest, and the past of both her childhood, young adult life, building her career, and then ultimately those threads meet near the end, where she gets up to the present day, but structured really well. I thought very grounded, and also did some interesting near the end, like pulling in of the pretty new science that we have around how nature and outdoor activity, in addition to just general physical activity, can be an important part of healing from trauma. There's a moment where like she does work with the same group that Florence Williams goes to do some work with in Heartbreak. And I read those in close proximity also. So it was just kind of a cool overlap. But she's a person that I want to hear more from. There's going to be an adaptation, and Selena Gomez is going to be playing her. So I'm excited to watch that at some point. But I would like to just continue following her life and the way that she talks about it. And I think aside from the fact that she has pretty graphic descriptions of the abuse that she suffered on the page, the book is relatively widely recommendable because she's taking these experiences that many humans have and then taking them out into an adventure memoir and doing, you know, a big experience that very few people have as a way to cope with an unfortunately very common experience that I think if you know the person that you're talking to,
yeah,
and what they can read and can't read, this is, I think, pretty widely recommendable. And one that just as I've like looked back over, what have I read so far this year at different points, I've always been glad to see that one on the list.
Selena Gomez going to try to pull a Wild make her. I mean, yeah. That's a great choice. I'd be curious to see how that gets pulled off. Mm-hmm.
It will be interesting.
I'll do one that I'm pretty sure isn't on your list because I don't think you read After Lives by Abdulrazak Gurna. Turns out good things are good, Rebecca Shinsky.
Tell me more about After Lives.
So it follows a couple of characters that are either related or closely linked over a generation and a half, I think, or so. Starting out in West Africa, getting swept up in German colonialism and wars. But it's really a tour. It's kind of a tour of Africa in this time. It's told with sparing detail and burnishment and adornment. And it really builds and builds and builds. And my favorite last 9 words of the year, to be very specific, it really sharpens and sharpens and speeds up in the last like 50 pages, where it's Gurna uses all of the experience, all the time you've had with these people, and all of their hardship, and all of their pulling together, and all of their victories, to give us a really moving, weirdly flashback to a character we barely know, and it kind of opens up the whole book in a way. Never read anything like it. I'm excited to have the whole Gurna corpus back, but it is. It's interesting when I talked about the 3 books in my mainstream literary fiction, all of those feel contemporary. To Paradise feels like a 2022 title. So does Candy House, and so does Sea of Tranquility, of these kind of like spec fic, lit fic, up markets, whatever you want to call this, you know, the genrefication of art writing in America. Afterlives feels like it could be written 100 years ago, and in 100 years, it will not feel out of place. It's like what I think Woody Guthrie said about folk music. It never feels of time, but it never feels out of time. And I think that's one thing that and Gurna is really doing it. It's not quite mythic, but and it is historical fiction, but it doesn't feel that way. And it feels timeless. That's the only way I can really think about it. And it's also not a period of time and places I know a whole lot about. So there's like, oh my God, it turns out colonialism in Africa is bad, Rebecca. Did you know
yes,
that?
Yes, I've heard. I've heard some things.
It looks like. But it's also not, it of course is about that, but it's not just about that. Like, that's the world they're in. And I've thought about the title a lot, and I'm still not sure what it means, honestly. And it's evocative without being descriptive, which, you know, my brain likes to work on. But it's really good. It's really something else. And there's no hurry to get to it. It doesn't matter that it came out this year. And it made some best of lists, rightly so. But it almost feels like this book making a best of 22 list feels like too small, weirdly.
Oh, interesting.
Anyway, there we go. After Lies, Adlerazza Gurna.
All right. I guess I'll stay in the memoir zone that I'm still coming out of. I do think this is going to be a shared favorite, and it's maybe the book I am the happiest I had in one of my drafts this year. Stay True by Hua Xu.
Yep, I have it too. Made the New York Times list. Big up.
Yeah. Really glad to see that. We had a good year of memoirs by New Yorker writers.
Did the other ones make it, by the way?
No. Okay. I thought about In the Early Times.
I included In the Early Times, but I'm sorry, Schultz. I love that book, but didn't quite make it. I couldn't do all three. I needed two. And go ahead.
And I think Schultz might have made it if it hadn't been competing with Wash U and Dad Friend for that Memoirs by New Yorker writers situation. But just such a gorgeous snapshot of a friendship at that time where you're a freshman in college and you're figuring out who you are in the world alongside these other people who are figuring out who they are in the world. It has a little bit of the Perks of Being a Wallflower flavor, just a little bit of, you know, being in the car with your friends and the music turned up loud and people are kind of razzing each other and the windows are down and the vibes are good and you just are like in this space with these people that you love. That
listening to a CD and going to buy a zine.
Yes.
Yeah.
And just, he captured that so well. And I think it's very much of its time, like what it felt like to be a young person at that particular moment in culture. But also, I think it will age well, that the music on the stereo will be different. They're not going to pick up CDs now. You know, people who are going to write memoirs about having been in college in 2022, like 20 years from now, those stories are going to look, the details will be different, but the feeling of being that age, I think, is pretty consistent. And he just captures it beautifully, and that, like, the depth and meaning of that friendship and what it meant to him at that point in his life. I read the end of it on a plane, and I think had to text you like, oh God, I didn't know it was going to make me cry at the end. We're going to have to develop some system where when you get to a book first, you just tell me, don't read this one in public.
Snot bomb. Do we have a snot bomb emoji? I don't
know. We do. We need a snot bomb emoji for like, don't read that on an airplane, Shinsky. This happens to me too often where like, the book is great, and then something at the in the middle or the end of it surprises me, and there I am crying in my aisle seat. But I really loved it. And I was just drawn to it. I remembered putting it on my draft list of just like, this just sounds great. Like, he's a New Yorker writer. I like his voice. This sounds like an interesting memoir. But, you know, it's his first book, and so it was kind of a flyer.
That's a flyer. That's a wonderful... You bought Hansen Energy Drinks in 91, which had a little thing called Red Bull.
Right.
And you're like, wow, that really took off. Good job, you. Yeah, it's fantastic. And I had In the Early Times by Tad Friend on my list as well. I listened to them back to back, and I couldn't separate them because they were right there. And I was like, New Yorker writers are the best thing ever. I don't want to listen to anything else in the history of the world. And I couldn't separate them. And both of them were new to me writers, and I was surprised in different way. If Stay True needed the snot bomb emoji, In the Early Times needed the eyes emoji.
Yes. Yeah, you did a nice job of telling me, like, just get ready.
Yes.
And it was still very surprising.
And also on a sentence level, spectacular.
Yep.
Some of my favorite sentences of the year happens in The Early Times with eyes emoji. Fathers and sons, which I'm very attuned to, for reasons that are because I am a son and I have a father, and that's how things go. Not that it's anything like this, but the dynamic I always find interesting. And it was a surprise. Like, I had this on my early watch list for some reason. I didn't pick it because who knows? And I don't know this writer particularly well. Stunning. A stunning book. Mm-hmm. Both of them stunning back to back. The only reason, and then I was trying to think about, why am I not including Lost and Found? They do go together in a lot of ways. I think for me, Schultz was trying to abstract from specificity in Lost mm-hmm. and Found of her own experience, where both of these books aren't about anything other than the stories and their own experiences. And in that way, they become transcendent by not trying to make it about, well, let's use a Herman Melville quote that I can apply to my father that's something about losing. It's like, it felt like that's a little too much. If you have a, she had good, just tell the story,
yeah.
tell it plain, tell it with heart and emotion and art and pathos. And I don't need the, I don't need that. You know, this reminds me of the Iliad. And that's me. That's me saying this.
I know. I had the same response in thinking about what made, especially Stay True, feel mm-hmm. so special. And it is that the specificity that grounds something that is universal. And Catherine Schultz, like, nothing is more universal than loss of a person mm-hmm. that you love. We will all experience that. And she could have just told that story and it would have done the work of
right.
this is my personal story. You will see yourself in it in some way. Your
Her father's a
story.
Wonderful character, much
yeah.
like Brad Friend and Sue have wonderful characters at the center
yes.
of their stories.
And it just didn't need all of that. And I think I wondered as I was reading it, and then as we talked about it, I think we wondered together, like, is all of this other stuff around it just Schultz's way of distancing herself mm. from the difficulty of the material, or is she trying to build some bigger structure for us to use to think about loss and grief, because I didn't think we needed you don't need a framework for no. going into a conversation like that or a story like that. We all have that experience, and just listening to another person tell their version of the experience, I think is where the magic is, and that's what was so potent to me about Stay True.
Yeah. And again, I liked Lost and Found.
Oh yeah,
I really did. It's just I'm now seeing if it's on my 14-headed Mount Rushmore, and it didn't quite make it there. So I kind of piggybacked off Stay True to get in the early mm-hmm. times on there. What do you have left, Rebecca?
I have a couple debut novels.
All
and
right.
So one of my fave debut novels this year was Memphis by Tara M. Stringfellow. Just, I love a gang gets back together kind of story. And this is not a lighthearted one. The framework is a woman leaving an abusive marriage, going into a home where one of the other kids in the home has assaulted one of her children. It's complicated. There are generations. There's generational stuff going on in this family. But it felt vibrant and rich, the world that she creates. I found it to be just a really strong debut. Probably not, like, if you just said to me, what are the best, like, literary novels of the year? I don't know that it's on my top list of those, but I think it's among the strongest debuts of the year, and it made me really look forward to what she'll do next. And then I'm just going to set you up here because
yeah,
my other debut, my other favorite debut of the year was Post-Traumatic, but you get the prize for finding that
one.
This
was my favorite debut. I think it's the only debut fiction I have. Yeah. I don't know why I picked this up. There's a bunch of books. I think, frankly, this is one of the few books I can remember where the cover did something for me at the beginning. It has, I think we talked about it on the show, or I mentioned it. I can't remember the various conversations we've had over, especially in the middle of the year. But it has a cover you don't see very much on literary fiction, which is a photograph of an actual person. Mm-hmm. And I think that's telling here, because Chantal Johnson, who's the writer, she herself has some experience in the world of the main character, especially in dealing with social services. She's a Black woman. I don't know. I haven't read. I'm sure there's an interview with Out Here that tells her how much of this particular character story is in it. I don't particularly care. I'd be interested, but I don't Mm-mm. care if that distinction makes sense. But it's a story of a woman who has trauma in her own life and who is flawed and who is chaotic and who is dealing with it. And she also knows all of that about herself. I think that's where the magic mm-hmm. really happens here. Is she has thoughts and observations about the world around her internally, and then she already has the, but I shouldn't think that, I shouldn't do that, that's not fair, but I'm thinking that anyway, and how, I mean, I think that's something that's not talked about enough, really, that internal back and forth and rip are sort of our psychological riptides that happen within our own oceans of self. That's what I think literary fiction especially can do that almost no other art form can, is to give us a portrait of interiority. And this has exteriority. She makes some decisions that are tough. Yeah. And the ending is interesting, and I'm still thinking about the ending. I'm not even sure I particularly care for the ending, but it does the thing that I think I want a literary ending to do, is like, it makes me reconsider the book, and it re-engages mm-hmm. and gives me a different perspective. I could imagine that this is, I hope she writes more, but I could imagine like this is the book she had in her. Mm-hmm. Like it kind of feels that way, like almost a Catcher in the Rye kind of way. I think I described it as a feeling having a modern day Catcher in the Rye. Not that they're anywhere related in terms of content, but it's a character wrestling with the world who's kind of messed up, and it feels so human. And I love this book. I really, this is my biggest wonderful surprise of the year to me, Post-Traumatic by Chantal Johnson.
I just totally agree. I second all of those emotions. It does the best job I've ever seen a novel do of what it really feels like to be a person living in a person's head.
Yes.
Right. Of what that is to like to have a feeling, to notice the feeling you're having, to have a weird thought and then have a thought about that thought.
And then, it doesn't work, right? Like we yeah. talked about like the trick, like the therapy sort of humanities trick is like, well, if you just know this about yourself, then you can master yourself.
No.
Ain't that easy, Rebecca?
No. Yeah. And she just puts it all on the page of like, there's the feeling, there's the thought, there's the judgment of myself of having right. had that thought. There's the, okay, let's try to have this other feeling about it. Wait, that's not working. Here's my judgment about this person I'm dealing with. I don't want to feel that way about them. Can I try to feel a different way? It's just so, you use the word human, and I think she just captures it so well. It's also really brave, a really yes. brave way to write yes. a story. And we don't know, as you were saying, I have avoided interviews. Like maybe somewhere she's talking about how much of this is from her and how much of it is fiction. I don't want to know.
Yeah, I don't want to know either.
I don't need to know. But she's done such a masterful job of just capturing that. And it's so brave to take that leap where not a lot, like literary fiction often, I think, relies on distance and often relies on a little framework or on like a one sentence nugget that is supposed to let you know a bigger thing about what a character's experience is like. And it's just bold to put us right in the head of someone in such a deep way for, 300 pages yeah. of, okay, no, really. This is what it's like to be this person. And this is the novel this year that more than anything else I read really left me feeling like, yes, I understand, because this person just told me what it is really like to be them in the world right mm-hmm. now. It was just wonderful.
I'm down to my last two, but before we get there, let's do our other sponsor break quickly. Okay, Rebecca, what do you have left?
Let's see. I have sleeper hit of the year that is a sleeper hit maybe only in my heart.
All right. Go.
But The Swimmers by Julia Otsuka.
That was my last cut, and I did not like it about myself. Yeah, okay, you go.
It's just quiet yeah. and strange, yeah. and I had some sentences that I loved, and was my first Julia Otsuka, but now I have The Buddha in the Attic sitting on my desk for next week. So I loved the introduction to her voice. I really just love it when a writer is like, let's go into this weird thing that's happening. Mm. You know, there's a crack in the bottom of the swimming pool. Is it sinister? Is it just a crack? Why are all of the people freaking out? Will we ever know? Probably not. And it's one of those, I don't know, I think I often love a novel where I find myself being like, there's no way I can explain to you what this book is about.
Nope.
You know,
no
when
shot.
I always know that that's a good sign. Like Bob and I are having dinner and I'm telling him about what I'm reading or he's asking, you know, and I'm like, well, I'm just going to have to tell you everything that happens in this book, and you're still not going to know what the book is about. So let's just not. You can read it if you want.
It's going to be like a manic episode when I describe this book to you, right. but that's,
Right. It sounds like, the description of it sounds like when you wake up from a really weird dream and you make your partner suffer through listening to the story of your really
yeah,
weird
definitely.
Dream. Like, none of it is the kind of plot you would suggest. For a novel. It's very strange and very quiet and nothing happens, but it's a vibe, and I really liked the vibe.
I like the vibe too. Yeah, I think the only reason it didn't make it further is that it was competing with Liberation Day for my Is This a Short Story collection or what is this? And I think the swimming pool, is that called The Swimmers, that novella? And I don't remember.
Yes.
Is that called The Swimmers? Yeah. You can imagine George Saunders having a similar conceit and doing really weird stuff with it. But I almost like that Otsuka doesn't. Like, she's just like, it's just a crack in the bottom of the pool that people start freaking out about.
Mm-hmm. Aren't
which
people
is really,
weird?
Is really, it's a little more on the Kafka-esque side in that regard. But Liberation Day, which did, Saunders just swings, and there's just so much, and it's so interesting and fascinating, oscillates. We did a whole episode about it on Patreon. You go listen to it. Between very grounded at one level and extremely not at the other level. And when it came right down to it, I had them both sort of at the end of my list, and it's just the sheer ambition of Saunders. That's that's what went out for me. No shouts Otsuka, but that it's just the amount, the volume of creation in Liberation Day is really stunning.
Yeah, that's on my list also. I don't even know where to put it on the list because Saunders has such range that it's just remarkable. He's so consistent and also just so expansive. And to be consistently expansive is really...
What else do you want?
Really impressive. Yeah, yeah. There's nothing else. It's wonderful. He's wonderful. That was just a big one on my list. And definitely proximity is benefiting it because we just read that. So I'm still really, really thinking about it. A couple like that I was going to sneak in at the end that I really had fun reading. I don't know how much I'm going to think about either of them in the future, but I really had fun this year with Flying Solo by Linda Holmes.
I had
Holmes.
Fun with that too.
Just
that's my
solid.
Happy. If my happiest while reading it, that's on my five.
Yeah, and Now Is Not the Time to Panic by Kevin Wilson, which just came out, which like this is, I don't know that there's a more straight shot to the center of the Shinsky wheelhouse than a story about two teenagers in the 90s who create a weird piece of art that accidentally sets off a satanic panic in their town, and that like 30 years later they're still living with. It just rang like every bell I've got.
Only if it were called Counting Crones would it be more in your wheelhouse.
Yeah. Just rang all my bells. It felt kind of similar to some of the stuff that the Yellow Jackets TV show was trying to do with like looking at what was happening at that time in pop culture. And Kevin Wilson, just also talk about consistent. Like, he's so consistent at what he does. Every book is its own vibe. It's going to be a little zany. It's going to be a little weird, but also very, very human. And some real zingers of like his characters observe things about their lives in one sentence that would have most of us in therapy for decades.
That's funny. I'm looking forward to that.
It's a good one.
I've been looking forward to having that over break time.
That's a good holiday break read. So that hits all of the ones I had. Is there anything lingering?
I've got one
for you?
More, and it's not last. It's just kind of how the cookie crumbled. And I think you're in the middle of this, maybe, or just finished the Solito by Javier Zamora. Mm-hmm. He's a poet, and it's his memoir of crossing from, I think he starts out in Ecuador, to the U.S. A harrowing story. The kind of book I've been hoping to read for a while. And I think the thing that so strikes me about it is one thing that poets are good at, especially they're good at language for sure, but also restraint, because generally the poem itself is a limited space. You don't have a book length container. And it's not so much that there's textual constraint here, but his restraint of judgment or politicizing certainly could, and it'd be warranted, but I think it actually becomes a strength. It's like, this is just what happened. And if you don't think it's inhuman, I don't know what to tell you. And all there's flawed people in it on all sides, I should say. There is good intention on many sides. But it is the kind of story that's both, you know, this is what it is. I mean, that's the thing that really got me. It's like, of course this is what it's like. I kind of know this, and it happens every day, and people are doing it all the time, and I don't know what to do about it. And the book isn't even really asking that. It's not really a call to action kind of a book. It is, this is my story. And that simple, the simple profundity of that, I think has a a pure power that is different than any kind of pontification or grandiose statement. It, you know, one kid, one 9-year-old, asked, told, made by his parents to do a crossing, the found family along the way, the sacrifice and fellow feeling, the danger, the inhumanity, and the beauty of transcendence of what happens. It's just remarkable. And again, if you're interested in this, I do, and you're an audiobook person, Zamora is a wonderful narrator. He does stuff with language and his own, and the Spanish that's involved. And there's pieces of it that you don't know what the characters are saying to each other because he gives it to in Spanish and there is no translation in the audiobook. I'm not sure if in the print book, if there would be an asterisk, I don't even know. I think I prefer it because it gives you that otherness as an English native speaker myself. I don't know their story. And there's a part of this that I can't know, and I'm experiencing it. But like on the very level of the line in those decisions about when we understand what the Spanish speaker is saying, when we're given access to that, and when it's withheld, I think is a fascinating microcosm of the whole experience here. So Salido by Javier Zamora, it's the last one on my list.
I'm really glad that you mentioned it when you were reading it or when you were listening to it. I'm about a third of the way in right now, and I'm reading it in print. There are not asterisks. There are not translations. Okay. So he does the same real invitation, and I've been struck by that as well, that it's of any topic, it's certainly one he could pontificate about, and he would have every right to from that experience.
Be well within moral whatever to do.
But just the bare invitation to the reader to witness what he experienced and let that speak for itself. It does all the work and then some. I guess let me do myself a favor. I'm getting on a plane this afternoon.
Yes.
Should I finish this book on a plane?
No.
Okay.
Well, I don't want to do that without spoiling it. It doesn't go as bad as it could, a story like this, in a lot of different ways. But this is not what I would pick.
All right.
Yeah.
We'll keep it lighter. I'll finish it where I'm sitting down somewhere.
Right, when you're sitting down somewhere.
A good year.
A really good year. Any other honorable mentions or near misses? I gave you The Swimmers. That was down to my last cut. That was the one I really struggled with, to be honest.
No, this is, I think I talked about everything that I'm really, really glad to have read. But I don't know, maybe it's just we've been doing this long enough, and maybe it's that I'm pretty ruthless about putting something down if it's not working for me. But like, I had a really good hit rate this year. There wasn't much I read that I was like looking back over my year that I wish I had spent that time with something else. So I feel good about that, but I think this is just such a strong field of books and so varied for a year where there wasn't a big novel of the year in the literary space. There wasn't something like Colleen Hoover ruled the year, but in the kinds of stuff that we read and are going to talk about, there wasn't one big story. And I like it in years where there's a big book or a couple like really big novels of the year. But I also think I've come around to really liking the space that not having a big book created for a whole bunch of smaller, really powerful experiences.
The freedom that the space itself offers books, right, is not like you don't have the problem. Well, not problem, but the condition of, say, TV or music or movies, that there is the possibility for something to cross over to be a mainstream hit. It doesn't happen. It happens so rarely that it's not even a part of what you get into this for. But that's liberating in a way, because you can read as idiosyncratically want and have a wonderful year and not feel like you're necessarily missing out on anything. On the other hand, you could read the, I don't know, such as it is mainstream, and had a good, I mean, I picked a lot, we picked a lot of mainstream lit books, like the hipster Brooklyn picks are, there's a lot of them on here. And you can have that experience as well, but you're never going to have the experience of like, you know, there is no Succession and Game of Thrones, oddly, of books. Just doesn't work that way. On the other hand, the range, books' range still crushes every other, maybe music, I guess I should say. But in movies and TV, it just takes so much money to make anything where you can write a weirdo book and get published by a weirdo press with just you and your pen and paper. It may not sell any, but you can make that art and it can go out into the world and people can get to it. And I still find that to be remarkable in its own way. I guess less, if we had to pick, well, we're going to get books of the year. I'm not going to step on that show later. All right, Rebecca, thank you so much. We're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to record our Patreon episode that's going up next week, and that's going to be the books we missed in 2022, things we didn't read that we kind of wanted to or thought we wanted to or maybe we'll get to eventually, but for whatever reason yet, here as we sit on December 1st, didn't make it on our We Read That list. So, Rebecca, thank you as always. Go to email us, podcast@bookriot.com. You can check out the Patreon, patreon.com/bookriotpodcast. You'll see the list of the books and the show notes for this episode, which I'll live with all of the other show notes to all the rest of our podcasts, bookriot.com/listen. Talk to you soon.